we've just been chewing the fat and trying to, and the interesting issues that you've raised, Commissioner Dawson, about, as we obviously understand a bit more about the phenomenon you're talking about, which is clearly not the sort of product that, so, that's been delivered here. So one of the ways is that, and I imagine that a lot of that issue that's been raised is through sort of corporates owning properties, bringing in people maybe one night at a time and then out, so you're getting a high turnover and all that sort of stuff. Whereas one of the suggestions, one of the performance standards that could be for the permitted activity status is the minimum 3-night stay. That would apply across the board. So that would apply to homestays and residential sort of accommodation. So that, and so then had a length of playing field, basically. And other things in terms of, this is getting a bit tricky, but obviously what would be ideal is obviously making sure that these are genuine ventures owned by individuals or family trusts or whatever, not corporate operations. And that's really hard to have that.
What's the difference if they're run in exactly the same way?
Oh, that's right, exactly.
I think the concern, if I may interrupt, Commissioner, is that with the ones that are coming in and like two of us is or four of any things, Mr. Chairman, is that they're often in one day, out the next. I think that's where the 3-day activity would be quite useful, and that certainly reflects the existing approach for registered holiday homes in the operative plan.
So there's 1 day, 2 days and 3 days, that's inconsistent across the various use types. So a homestay is 1 night, registered is 3 nights, and then the resource consent is 2 nights. So there probably are issues in the current operative plan. So if there's equalised across all of those, the arbitrage that's happening now would diminish. In some of these situations of the vans coming in and out, probably would not be the case if we start looking at a consistency of threshold across all the different activity types.
And we've certainly also heard from people who lease out their houses or parts of their houses or a flat attached to their house that they don't like the 3-day limit. It stops the weekend let, whether it's for an event or something, which there are lots.
Especially
in Wanaka, every weekend over the summer there's a weekend event and there's a lot of rental.
But I think if councils, if we look at the levers that council has to play with and you're trying to balance a variety of needs, I guess something has to give. And, you know, we operate as Batchelor, we operate under the 3-night minimum, and our owners are able to get the occupancy, so it just depends on the different levers that you want.
That's fine, but and one of the things that council has to be cognizant of is the way we're heading forward, and Boeing, Airbus, all the big aircraft manufacturers are effectively saying that 50% of their production is going into the emerging economies, China and India. Not trying to be racist, although it's hard not to, but to describe a group of people and their travelling habits, that's the group that would be using that facility more often than not. So therefore, how do you catch that is then the question. And the point that you made, Mr. Miles, before about the size of the group, it's sort of an analogy I used before, is that the number of people that are recidivist drunk drivers. Well, there's not a huge group, but their impact is kind of massive. And that's sort of where a lot of the focus has been on. Appreciate the fact that potentially it's not in your specific realm, but it still ends up being something that we have to deal with. How do you deal with it? How do you fit that into standards and rules and methods and policies?
I do agree that, you know, if you look at the emerging travellers and where the change is coming from, India and Asia, particularly China, and the growing middle class, you know, there's going to be 500 million travellers outbound, which will kind of disperse all over the world. So it is an issue for us to cumulatively do, I guess, comprehensive.
Beautiful problem.
You've put our problem well.
Yeah.
Well, so, I mean, I've listened to your range of answers from you all, and it's been extremely helpful, thank you. So that's, what I've heard is suggestions about, in terms of standards that could be applied to permitted activities. I've heard about registration, records and reporting, potential fire safety, health and safety matters, which might actually already be in that appendix, potentially the number of people per bedroom, which was in your original submission, one group per property, which were also in your submission, and now this whole question of minimum number of stays, and there could be other matters. We've still got quite a bit of evidence to hear. We've got another hold for tomorrow and next week, and we're a long way from coming to any determination on this, but it would be really helpful if you were able to put in writing some suggestions for the rules and also assessment criteria for if your proposal for an RDA is to be followed through on. Thank you.
And I think in doing that, Chris, I think you'd have to be cognizant that each standard could be breached individually.
Yes.
So if you were going to recommend the 3-day minimum, would that have a different assessment criteria or different matters of expression for someone to go for a 1-day minimum? If you're posing that. So I think it would be helpful if you could put all that into a rule.
Which are the important ones, yeah.
So, I mean, have you
What would be the timing to get
that? That was the least thing I was about I think Wednesday the 23rd.
First one is, you talk in paragraph 617 of your evidence, Chief, you talk there about the retention of residential character and how the draft is all the difference between subject to certain conditions between RBA and ordinary residential. Would you understand residential amenity to include the concept of residential coherence as part of that? Looking at that in terms of homestay, because obviously what you're saying, all homestay should be brought into the same category, could it be argued again from the devil's advocate point of view that homestay does have one advantage over all home rentals in the sense that you've got somebody on the property who's literally a resident of that community. In other words, you've got roots in the community, if we use the corny term. Does that provide some basis for treating homestays way the council has, in other words, giving them a bit of a head start over all the RBA. We've got someone who's got to be there to look after the place, to provide on-site management, and they live there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you need to look at it from an off-site effects point of view. And so, you're right about the fact that with someone there, and effectively a supervisory sort of capacity, you probably have less likelihood of party. Well. homestay, you can potentially have more traffic generation than you would with a whole of house. You also have typically a signage on the front of it on the property, which is usually bigger and more visually prominent than you would as you walk past to have little signs like this that just go on along the mail, bottom of the mailbox sort of thing. So you know those facilities.
There are no signs under the council regulations. So there are no signs here. But in the Southern Lakes District, Batchcare operates nationally as a full service management company. We manage nearly 1,800 properties across the country. In the Southern Lakes, it's one of the most computed areas for full service management. So a proportion of the homes being fully managed versus other areas that are unmanaged where there's a neighbor looking after it. It would be interesting to understand the evidence behind problems arising from unhosted versus owners supposedly on site, because a very high proportion, and Mr. Miles will know from Bogovich's listings, how many are from management companies here. We all have our reputations to maintain, we all have contact details and we're available after hours if problems arise. So I don't know how much an issue it really is on the fully managed versus hosted, because we don't know if the hosts actually stay on site. There is equal anecdotal evidence where hosts leave to make more money to maximize their income, and the hosted actually isn't hosted. So I think we just need to be careful of whether hosted really is hosted and whether unhosted really is hosted, because there is a large person.
And I think sort of endorses the treatment in the same way.
I think we have to be careful with all of it, because I have said as a hearing commissioner on an application for a property for accommodation, which was a large property, a very high overnight rate, with no on-site management, causing very large, very adverse resident community effects on the neighbours, because they had the two-person per-bedroom rule meant they could fit 15 in the house, and because of the cost, it was only the only people who could afford it were groups of Australians coming for the weekend to have a party. And so I think you have to be careful with, no matter how carefully you look at the rules, there are always going to be exceptions, and it's not one versus the other necessarily.
That's right. So yeah. And it could be like that could be addressed by an upper limit, you think, is different.
There are a number of conditions that were imposed on the consent for the owner itself.
Yeah. There's also ideas around things like code of conduct, which in Australia has been reasonably useful. And something that we're looking at as well as an industry. Because for us, it's not good for the industry to have those kind of party houses existing. They are an outlier. They're not, not really valuable to us. So we would rather see them removed.
Jump into that. Just as regard to the code of conduct, is it New South Wales? I'd be interested to hear your comment.
Yeah,
well, it's been reasonably useful.
There's the Holiday Rental Industry Association in Australia that came up with a code of conduct, which was really developed even prior to the Airbnb kind of existing, so they've had it for a number of years. What we're looking at doing in Australia and would like to do in New Zealand is a similar kind of industry-wide code of conduct, which lays out a number of sort of performance requirements in order to kind of remain in the industry, if you like. But obviously it requires, for that to work, you've kind of got to have all the parties on the same page.
Is that its strengths and weaknesses, like you're saying, identified that all the parties on the same?
Yeah, I think where it's been a struggle in Australia is getting all the parties to, and because Airbnb was sort of late into it, getting everyone to sort of agree to what the sort of delisting criteria, what the delisting process, and getting that piece to work has been a bit difficult.
Thank you.
Now, it has been or will be suggested to us that a fundamental reason not to have any restrictions on RVA is because you don't know if people hearing is that Booker Badge says there should be some kind of registration system,
correct?
And there was a legal High Court case that was attached to the Corporate Office, and I take it you would agree with that, would you?
That was the notification.
With the idea of having pre-notification.
That's right. I read that case, the High Court case, and I agree with the Council's legal submissions that that was perfectly permissible with the
lawful approach.
Yes.
Okay. Now, one is, just go back to the example you gave, Mr. Christopher, about two persons per bedroom. The example we heard from this morning was a duplex unit end of a narrow accessway, not a cul-de-sac, just an accessway. And the overseas owner had basically converted, each one had three bedrooms, he converted one to four bedrooms, the other to five, as I understand, he was thinking about converting a garage to a bedroom as well. Under your proposed example, that would allow 22 people on the site. The neighbour was having some concerns with the 13 she'd already counted on. So does this, again, if you're thinking about rules, I'm pointing out you may need to look at a reasonably fine-grained system by the rules for assessment matters.
Yes, and an upper limit as well.
Yeah, yes, I think
yeah.
I was thinking of another item. Next question I'm going to ask is, we've heard from a lot of people who said that, you know, open idea body would ever go back from RBA to rental accommodation, why people wouldn't have a bar, but no one can understand that message has been received by, you know, really loud and clear. I guess one of the concerns I do have, though, is in terms of people seeking to buy a house in this district or build a house in this district, as to whether RVA is, well, put another way, rental accommodation simply can't compete with RVA, which could have an effect on the rental mix. And one of the reasons for that being that with RVA you can have access to the house whenever you want to. If you can't with rental, I understand the government's going to change the law to make it impossible to be rented. Because if the tenant wants to stay there for 20 years, you can, and that's what the government's proposing. So, also looking at the evidence we've heard as to the income you can derive from RBA compared to long-term rental, we've seen in this district at least there's almost no contest insofar as rental is concerned. Do you think there is some justification to the council's concerns in view of what we've heard from submitters that future investment in this district will be heavily skewed towards RVA and against rental, simply because rental's not competitive?
Good question.
This is why we put forward the plan for the sub-zone overlay, because we can kind of see that happening, right? I mean, the problem with Queenstown is there's nowhere bad to live. You know, it's all beautiful, right? So if you launch new land, then people are going to come buy it. And, you know, that's an issue. So so I guess to address what you're saying, I think that's kind of what the subzone overlay idea was all about. It was trying to make it clear that certain areas were residential.
To assist through Mr. Christopher, the evidence we heard this morning was that the cost of building in this district is so high that the homestay or RBA, or particularly the homestay element, is one way in which people can afford to build a house, even in the most ordinary suburbs. It's not the most expensive. So that has to be taken into account and answering the question.
Yeah, no, yes. I think that's absolutely right. It's one of the points I was going to make is that it does provide an opportunity to improve affordability if you can get some income from your property, whether it's through home state or renting, if it's a batch situation, to rent it out periodically. And as I pointed out before, if you shorten up the supply, price. So you're going to compound that issue of making section 10.9 of the council's memorandum sets out a pretty impressive list of, all sorts of things that are happening, both in the district and around the country, in terms of addressing these issues, which, as I said, my advice, I think will be far more effective in terms of addressing that issue than basically shortening up the supply of offshore stay accommodation, which, as I say, would just make it more expensive and make sure it remains empty longer.
Just turning to the issue of perhaps having subsidies, a witness we heard from this morning is shot over country, and he basically told us that he's aware of other examples in that suburb where people have only been able to get a house because the house is built with like a flat, which could be used for either Airbnb or for rental purposes. Now, if they were restricted, it would seem that could create a significant problem of possibly not a lot of these people out of the market, because the initial example, basically going for a bank loan, the bank would end up looking at this eye-watering mortgage schedule, and convince the bank you've got supplementary income, that is a huge help to be able to buy a house. So it enables people to meet their dream of living in this district. So I guess one of the concerns of, I guess it's a concern I have, is that if you differentiate by area, that will intensify the effect of adverse coherence impacts on existing neighbourhoods, while making it difficult for people, or more difficult for people, to buy in new areas.
I agree with you, Chloe. And that's where I think we will come back to just focusing on the existing neighbourhoods and the plan, but keeping to the same limit. So we're always seeing this. There's a line of less resistance, if you like, in terms of raising other issues around potential consequences.
But the only other question I had really, I guess it's a question about what it meant, because the word match has come up quite a lot in both the evidence you presented. But we have a cultural New Zealand image of what a match is, and sometimes you go to a tourist shop, and you see these paintings they have,
you
know, what a traditional Kiwi match is. But, it seems a traditional Kiwi bash in this district is sort of 1.5 million glass clad monstrosity, which is not typically what you'd like to do with bash. It's a much, it's a full scale house made of 4 or 5 bedrooms. So,
I guess the tag of bash is your secondary home, sort of thing. So, it doesn't need to imply that it's already sort of low quality or rusticness.
Maybe it's split to do different markets. Now, we heard an example during the hearing of about Kingston, someone from Kingston, and that does have, it's a very small place, but it does have a lot of the old batches, and they seem to be almost exclusively holiday homes. But what we call a batch nowadays, the council is basically arguing, is a house, which might or might not be available for the rental market.
Yeah, it's cemented.
The benefit of going last, everyone's asked all the good questions. And that's not
my first.
Couple of points. I'm going to poke again at the residential subzones, even though that has dropped off. And just to emphasise that lines, Judge Jackson's textile, for example, and the O&L line, that's caused lawyers rich forever. And how you came to set up those, and the fact that, you know, we've heard from assisting people, if you say it's just existing use rights, then what happens if inside that line someone's got existing use, and then it just becomes a whole.
Yes, and that's where the registration should hopefully cut through some of that, because then the council has the information where and they can, you know, specify what information they want to, and they can include when did the activity establish as well. That will help in terms of whether people are relying on existing use rights or whether they're doing it pursuant to the rules of the plan.
But it also does seem to, as a Scotsman that's arrived in New Zealand, you know, obviously I want the door to be shut now, I'm here. but you know, it's the same sort of argument almost, you know, that you've got, that's fine, so therefore no one else can do, you know.
Yeah, well, it was a response, as Peter said, it was a response to trying to you know, be cognizant of the issue that council was dealing with. And giving people you know, who are building in new areas, saying, right, this is the new regime. But and we accept entirely that does create a sort of two-tier sort of regime for the disorders.
I do also want to emphasise that I can't remember who said it, but it was in God We Trust and All Others Bring Data. And we're in this void at the moment where the data is not here. So if we could all reassemble in 10 years' time and have this conversation again and see if we actually worked it out, it'd be great.
Well, that's exactly what you will do, because that's your life in your district plan.
Yes. Well, let's hope that there will be one, yes. The other was the number of days. The discussion, and we've heard very, you know, a whole variety from absolute abolition through to, I think the Australian New South Wales came out with 360 and 180 or 190. 179 was the
hit. So, yeah, a full year or half year.
Yeah. So, and the Millbrook, interestingly enough, came out with 179. And I just wonder how you, if you could expand again.
Yeah.
I listened to a couple of snippets before.
So just out of my evidence, that was IHN and that response in response to the memorandum petition. And I guess the distinction there is that because two things really. One is that because it's in that sort of more rural sort of environment. But secondly, because it's got a specific zone which is set up for that type of purpose, and having that activity is entirely consistent with that.
But wouldn't you say that that book of nature essentially is, let's call it like local zone, and their criteria to enforce, to recommend, to exclude, to include?
Well, yeah, from an
effect. In a way, it's almost the
whole. Yeah. And in terms of the way Book of Action Based Care operate, it is distinct from the issues that Commissioner Dawson was raising, which we sort of understand is a different modus operandi. In terms of the way my clients are doing that, it is akin to, as I said, my evidence, it's indistinguishable in terms of residential amenity from the point of view of when someone's occupying the house. And as I say, the house has been occupied to me is more akin to residential character and a residential environment than a ghost town.
And on that point, the most indistinguishable and mostly indistinguishable, there's a few phrases you've used to coin there. I know Commissioner Nugent. I don't know you. So isn't that part of the residential immunity in terms of knowing
your neighbours? In terms of residential, that's true.
You know, just in terms of being indiscernible, you know, if you had big Scottish and Englishman moving in next door, whatever, it's a different, I get your point, but there are
it's quite, I guess it's quite subtle from a, in terms of that whole residential cohesion sort of type of viewpoint. You might agree that you don't know, as a batch owner, you might not say at the same time as your neighbour does in their batch, where you might see them once a year or something like that. You know,
Every 20 years,
yeah.
It's quite a few times.
Glendu B turns to 5,000 people.
Yeah, you might not like them as well.
The same people, yeah.
It's the same people, you know
their name.
And the two plus two guests per bedroom plus two, as Commissioner Nixon mentioned, that does seem to be a big number.
That's a function of the size of the house, obviously.
Yeah, exactly.
And if a house has been built, as presumably as a permitted activity, and can have that number of bedrooms, then that's the level of accommodation that the plan is provided for, and the effects that go along with that. With all these stories. So it's just a case of then what are the difference in effects if there's people coming in and staying for short stay versus being there either permanently or being owner occupiers that are occupying it at that same level. The difference is in why I was going to press up.
So just make a comment on that, Commissioner. So the 2 plus 2 is the two per bedroom plus two is something that we did take from the Quality Rental Industry Association's guidelines, and really it's, think of it as a holiday home with a couch that converts into a double bed. That's sort of the model, if you like, and the real purpose of it is to prevent the sort of rooms becoming bunk rooms with, three bunk beds per room for five rooms, that kind of thing, and so that was a thinking around it. But it's certainly from an overcrowding of the properties standpoint, setting an upper limit would be fine.
Yeah. And that's, in my business in Monaco, we employed a girl who just recently was paying $170 for a bed and 6 bedroom.
Yeah.
And that's the standard pressure on, which is one of the goals that we're trying to keep in the air. That's thank you very much.
Okay. Just one correction. Traveling the 20th, Wednesday 26th.
Oh, Wednesday
26th. Thank you. She was happy with 23rd, and she was
happy with 23rd. What would have happened if I would have looked at the calendar? I would have been
very much. Well, it would have been 4 years' time. No other questions. I don't know if I asked. One question that I did have, in terms of the registration issue, there's an existing registration system. You're proposing a new registration system. Would you see as part of that the existing registrations would be transferred into the new system? Or just left as existing use permits?
Yeah. Probably the same system, basically, but possibly with modifications.
But it might be a slightly different system.
Yes.
It might have different standards. Yes.
It might be that you update and you require those that are already registered to update their registration.
You might want to keep in mind to that and how that could be expressed.